Hi, I'm Scott Simon from NPR. Welcome to a special edition of Marian McPartland's Piano Jazz. I'm joining you today just because an old friend of mine and a hometown hero, Studs Terkel, can't be with us. I grew up in Chicago, where Studs was one of the most compelling voices on radio for nearly 60 years. Of course, he had a unique and animated interviewing style that had a way of drawing out details and forgotten memories from his subjects. Same time, he was able to hone in on the essence of someone's story. Certainly made for great listening, but those interviews, collected on some 9,000 tapes, are also sort of a series of snapshots of life in 20th century America. Of course, Studs went on to write numerous award-winning oral histories on the Great Depression and World War II, but his very first book, Giants of Jazz, profiled jazz artists including Louis Armstrong, Count Basie, and Dizzy Gillespie, just to name a few. One of Studs' favorite jazz musicians was NPR's own Marian McPartland. They shared a love of jazz, of radio, and Chicago. Marian calls the Windy City her second home. That's got everything to do with the Chicago jazz man that both Marian and Studs loved, the cornetist Jimmy McPartland. More about him later. Marian was a guest on Studs' radio show several times over the years, and in 1991, Studs joined Marian on her show Piano Jazz. Like any piano jazz program, there was great music and some wonderful talk. Unlike other piano jazz programs, there were two seasoned interviewers in the studio that day. Given his enthusiasm for Marian and her music, Studs quickly turned the tables on her.
My guest today on Piano Jazz is a renowned author, philosopher, radio host, and the most astute social observer of our time,
wow.
Mr. Studs Terkel. How are you, Studs?
A lot of adjectives, Marian.
Yeah,
I was thinking about
all...
you, Marian. I think about you and the piano and this program of yours, heard over public radio for more than a dozen years, about 13 years or so.
Just about, yeah.
We'll have to ask about you, your life, too, as how that came to be. After you're English. You're from England.
Right.
You met an American jazz man out of Chicago, Jimmy McPartland.
One of your dear buddies for many years.
And the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, well, you knew Jimmy a long time before I did. He used to talk about Little Louis.
Little Louis, we did a program together way back. But I'm thinking about what you do at the piano. You didn't begin as a jazz artist when you were in England. Your family wasn't musical.
Well, my mother played sort of rather nice Chopin waltzes,
what,
things
for
like
example?
This. Well, she would play things like that's probably the first thing I heard when I was a kid, was that particular waltz. And you know, I was only about three, and I just thought I'd get up there and sit on the piano stool and try to play it. That's how I got started playing.
So there was sort of a genteel musical background. And into the scene, it's World War II. We're now talking about World War II. And the Yanks are there. And one of them is Jimmy McPartland. Raffish Jimmy.
Raffish. I love that word.
Yeah.
That just describes him. Well, of course, I was with USO camp shows. I went to France at the start of the invasion. And that's where I met Jimmy. He was in Belgium. And we were married there.
What were you playing then?
I was playing
for the
troops, and we were playing all those songs. We were playing things like that were very popular with the GIs at that time, like "I Don't Want to Walk Without You," like. Thought of that in years. You just made that come to my mind.
But you were, here's a sentimental ballad of that period of the 40s, of late 30s, 40s, from the Depression to World War II. Now what happened? Jazz happened. How would you play that as a jazz artist? A simple
maybe not too far removed, yeah. Maybe just improvise a little bit, like...
You've done just now, and that's why your program is so more than endearing. It's so enlightening and entertaining. It began a moment ago as you were playing very simply a fragment from a piece during World War II, a popular love ballad, and then something happened. That something happened, meeting Jimmy and jazz and its effect. So jazz, you added that something called improvisation.
Right.
Which basically is the heart of jazz, is not.
Well, I really feel that I learned so much more about how to improvise and how to play behind horn players. I mean, actually, after I met Jimmy, I played with so many musicians there in Belgium and in France that it opened up my ears quite a bit. And then, of course, when I came over here, that's when things really started to happen.
And so when you came over here, and to some extent there, you met colleagues of Jimmy, others, which leads, of course, to the big subject. Jimmy, the young man with the horn, had a mentor, and his name was Bix Beiderbecke. And thinking about Bix's genius and what you do, how you recreate the work of Bix, as you probably can do it now. And Bix was influenced a lot by the Impressionist French composers like Debussy and Satie. You know, Debussy, and also when he wrote a song, In a Mist, that had the French Impressionist influence,
didn't
it? It's
funny, he was ahead of his time with all those four pieces, In a Mist and Candlelights, and Flashes, and In the Dark. I mean, he never would have got those down on paper if it hadn't been for Bill Challis. And I learned that thing in England, In a Mist. You know, I mean, I don't play it according to the music, but I can sort of play a little my own arrangement of it.
How do you play it? In a Mist.
I'll show you.
Thank you. So thinking of Leon Bix Beiderbecke, Davenport, Iowa, at the piano, we think of Bix, of course, young man with a horn. He was it, the trumpet, the brass
horn. Isn't
it
amazing the harmonies that he got, though, at that time? I mean, it was unusual for a jazz player to be able to sit down and come up with these sort of... that kind of harmony.
That's what you do, Marion. Continue. See, you're telling us now about harmony. I know little about harmony. You're explaining it to me now through the piano. Continue with that. You said it's amazing how Bix gets the harmonies, understands it. Can you further demonstrate that?
Well, everything was so that he played when he was playing the horn was so sort of straight ahead, like when he would play, well, for instance, Davenport Blues, was, you know, like... different from something that had Debussy-like harmony. Like this phrase. It's beautiful. I can't explain it technically.
Marion,
I'm terrible at that.
I realized... what you've done. You fused, adding to a traditional jazz piece, Dixieland piece, for want of a better phrase, Davenport.
Yeah.
That other something that makes jazz as it grows. That's what you
well,
do.
Well, you know, you could take Davenport and you could actually add chords to it, make it sound different. You could do that.
Now.
You could, for instance, play it in a different key.
Mm-hmm.
Marion McPartland playing Davenport Blues, a piece she learned from her husband Jimmy, and one that he learned from his mentor, Bix Beiderbecke. You'll find Stead's portrait of Bix Beiderbecke, Young Man with a Horn, in his book, Giants of Jazz, and you'll hear more of Marion and Stead's in just a minute. Our program is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. I'm Scott Simon. This is a special edition of Piano Jazz from NPR. Hi, Scott Simon back here in a special edition of Piano Jazz from NPR. Studs, of course, is synonymous with radio in Chicago and across the country. His start in the business goes all the way back to the 1930s. He didn't begin as an interviewer.
I was a gangster. I was a Chicago gangster in radio soap operas. I terrified Ma Perkins and Mary Marlin, who suffered more than St. Teresa ever dreamed of suffering, courtesy of Oxidol. And so I was a gangster, always getting killed. Well, now, getting killed is not the bad thing. I'm out of a job. So therefore, I became a disc jockey from the standpoint of just keeping a job. And that's when the first guy I knew was Jimmy McPartland and Bud Freeman. I think the very first interviewees of mine.
Really?
I'm talking about 39, 40.
Oh, my goodness.
1940. Radio is very intimate, by the way. You and I are talking now. I'm assuming there's one person Yet we know there are scores of thousands listening, because you're carried by a couple of hundred public radio stations. But as you're playing and as I'm talking, I'm assuming we're talking to one single person.
It's funny, I have that feeling too. I get a picture in my mind of somebody maybe sitting in a chair or knitting, or somebody out woodworking.
See, when FDR, Franklin D. Roosevelt, was president, he instituted something called fireside chats.
Yes.
He talked on the radio. Well, those fireside chats were like nothing ever before or since. What it was is, even though his voice is a patrician voice, but I'm quoting an old friend of yours, Alec Wilder.
I'll ask you about him in a moment.
Yeah. But he was talking about Roosevelt in the days of the Depression and Prohibition, and hearing that voice, it was suddenly a voice of hope in the midst of despair and depression. And even though it's a patrician voice, I'm quoting Alec Wilder, it caught everyone because he's talking to one person. Could be that old couple on the farm, or a young husband and wife and little kid in the city lost. And so what we're doing right now is talking to one. Yet we know there are scores of thousands listening, because you're carried by a couple of hundred public radio stations.
It's great, isn't it, to have that? And I'm thrilled about it, to have people out there listening. And when I travel across the country, I see so many people who are listeners to the show. You know, you were talking about Alec Wilder and
Alec was a character.
Wasn't he?
He was a curmudgeon. He could not stand pretense. He could not stand pomposity. So you'd see him. You wouldn't see him in 5 years. And you say, Alec, how are you? He says, let me tell you. You know what happened the other day? As though you had seen him 5 minutes ago, you know?
I know. It's funny. He would call me on the phone, and it would be the same thing. Maybe I hadn't talked to him for weeks, and he'd say, yes. That would be his first word.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, so-and-so and so-and-so. But real loud, very booming tone.
But what is it he did with music? Lyrics and music. So we think of Alec's... It's
octets.
So peaceful in the country while we're young. These are classics that he would simply do seemingly casually, yet we know he was a disciplined craftsman.
God, the first things I heard, you know, were in England before I ever knew I would ever meet Alec, with the octets. Remember those with a sort of half classical, half jazz with the harpsichord?
These were chamber music.
Harpsichord,
chamber jazz, and had titles like Jack, This Is My Husband.
Yeah.
Now think of that. Jack, you got the whole story right there. Jack,
I know. This is
another one called The Amorous Poltergeist.
Yeah,
these are his titles. Gives you an idea.
The house detective registers.
He would write chamber music. He wrote a cantata for the United Nations. I know that.
Beautiful, with children's voices.
Yeah. Oh, you know about that one. Yeah.
Children's Plea for Peace.
Yeah, that's
gorgeous.
It. That's it.
But his best known, of course, was I'll Be Around. You want to hear?
Oh, you betcha.
You do?
Of course.
You know, I'll play for you at the drop of a hat.
Thank you.
What is it, Alec Wilder? It's Alec Wilder. What is it he did? It's a ballad at the same time as jazz in it. There's an improvisatory air. Even you assume as he wrote it, he allowed for this improvisation, it seems.
It's funny. Alec loved to hear people improvise, and yet he wanted to hear his melody. He would get mad if you didn't play the melody, and yet if you didn't improvise, he wanted both things.
Yeah, he did. For some reason, he was really very uncompromising and very obstinate, too. But he, for example, he was sore at Billie Holiday. He would criticize it because not enough of the original melody is in it.
Oh,
he wanted improvisation, but would get mad when too much liberty was taken.
Well, he wanted it like a Bach fugue. He wanted to hear the melodic part first and then improvise. Like if you took too many liberties with the first chorus, that's what he didn't like. So I used to try to do that for him. But I mean, with that song, he wrote the words to that, too, and it's so haunting. You know, I'll be around, like, you can just think of the person, even though they've been jilted and thrown on one side, he's going to still be there for that person.
That's the thing about Alec. He was a very sophisticated writer of lyrics. Alec Wilder was not the kind of commercial, right? He wanted that piece to be right. Whether or not it was a $1 million sale or not, he wanted to be right.
That's true. He never did write for, you know, quote, the market. He didn't do what was fashionable. And actually, he used to get rather, if you recall, he would get a sort of bitter at times that people didn't take his stuff. But that's how he was. I mean, it was wonderful to see somebody that just does their thing and they're not going to be swayed by
fad or fashion. Mabel Mercer,
who, of course, had
her own following, tremendous following. I would say lonely young men primarily, but many people listened to Mabel Mercer, and she loved Wilder's lyrics as well as the song. Mildred Bailey sang Month in the Country.
And Peggy Lee, and of course he got mad at Peggy because she didn't adhere to the correct middle part of While We're Young. She did something, because the melody has long pauses in it, and he said when he took that tune to the Brill Building, to the publishers, they didn't want it because it didn't have enough movement in it. Mm. Like the tune is like goes. Like it has a long pause. They didn't want a tune where nothing was happening, where you had to hold the note. So he got, he did get it published eventually, but in the beginning.
And just as you did it. Of course, it's dramatic. It's the story he's telling. You see, do that again, what you just did.
While We Were Young, the great Alec Wilder tune played by Marion McPartland. Alec was just the kind of character that could fascinate a man like Studs Terkel. Both men were certainly one of a kind, and we'll continue our remembrance of Studs Terkel in just a minute. You can find artist information, set lists, and more on our website, pianojazz.npr.org. I'm Scott Simon. This is a special edition of Piano Jazz from NPR. Scott Simon back here in a special edition of Piano Jazz from NPR. You know, a number of years ago, I was having a drink with Studs Terkel. There's a woman who came over and began to tell Studs a story about how she had had sex with space aliens. It took about 15 minutes. She went off, and I leaned over to Studs, and I said, "This must be a terrible burden for you, because people must consider you some kind of oral historian of last resort." Never forget, she said, "You know, Pally, she wasn't telling me that she had sex with space aliens because she had. That's just a way of getting attention. That's just a way of people making you listen to them. So that's the thing, Pally. You got to listen to people, because once they have your attention, they get that story out of the way that gets your attention. Then you can really hear what they have to say." I never forgot that. Whether Studs was interviewing so-called ordinary people or a celebrity, someone whose name you would know, Studs felt that each person's story contributed to the richly textured fabric that's America. He made the people whose names you didn't know into people whose names you wanted to know. Of course, he was considered an oral historian, but he could also be described as an anthropologist or an ethnographer, whose particular area of interest was the American experience. Now, music certainly has its own way of capturing that experience. Here's Marion performing a tune by George Gershwin, a man whose music embodied the spirit of an age.
So this is Marion McPartland, of course, Gershwin. Who more American? And capturing the jazz age in Gershwin, that's the ballad, Someone to Watch.
Someone to Watch Over Me. Isn't it amazing how he did so many wonderful songs? And I mean, and yet a lot of his music was classical. He wrote wonderful concerto. Of course, Rhapsody in Blue is a combination of, you can't really pigeonhole that, but I mean, he's written so many wonderful tunes that all of us continue to play and sing. I think one of the first ones I learned was in England, of course, was this one, Embraceable You.
Thank you. course, Gershwin, who was, of course, in a class by himself. We think of also the combination, his brother, the great lyricist, Ira Gershwin, and how the music, he kept, we know, we speak of the jazz age, the 20s, post-World War One, and there's perhaps never any composer, any country who could capture an age, a certain spirit, as he was able to do.
Wasn't it great, nice to hear all these songs on the BBC? God, you know, you think of so many tunes and so many composers and beautiful tunes. You know who I really love as a composer is Hoagy Carmichael. And not a bad pianist either. We used to play two pianos years ago at Sherman Fairchild's in New York.
See, you've named Hoagy Carmichael. Here's another aspect of American popular music.
When people think of Hoagy, they immediately think of...
As you play that, I don't think there's been any tune, popular or otherwise, that has been recorded or played as often.
Stardust.
These are called show tunes. Some are from musical comedies and very great ones, too. So the show tune written brilliantly by the lyricist and the composer, Rodgers and Hart, or whoever the other composer,
Yip
Harburg
and
Burton Lehner.
Howard Dietz and Arthur Schwartz.
The combinations. What does the jazz pianists do with them? They're the show tunes.
Well, they had so much to them, and they had a wonderful melody. You had the lyric to sort of digest and think about that if you wanted to, and you could, of course, this is what the jazz people love to do, is take the tune apart and play, do different things with it, like you change key, change tempo, like you can go, you know... to do, though, for you, that I think is the best tune ever written for jazz people, or just as a beautiful tune, All the Things You Are by Jerome Kern. Thank you. Byron is probably turning in his grave.
Yeah, what you've done, Audrey, you didn't profane Kern. What you've done is, that's what a jazz pianist does. I imagine Kern would have liked it.
Well, years ago, I stole something from Johnny Guarnieri, who undoubtedly you knew and probably had on your show.
Long, long, long ago.
And he played all the things you were on. He did this.
Marion McPartland performing All the Things You Are. And you'll hear more of Marion and Studs in just a minute. Our program is made possible in part by the Friends of Piano Jazz and is a production of South Carolina ETV and Radio. I'm Scott Simon. This is a special edition of Piano Jazz from NPR. As promised, here's a little more on that Chicago jazz man who first introduced Marion and Studs, Jimmy McPartland.
Come back to Jimmy again, the guy you met and married, the American, ravages the word, trumpeter Jimmy McPartland, who played a big role in introducing you to the world of jazz.
He certainly did. Without Jimmy, I probably would never have got started, truthfully.
And it was World War II. And I was thinking, there's so many stories about Jimmy on his way to the front, when he played with his band on the ship going to Europe during the war. And guys, we ran into guys during the tribute to Jimmy, who were his mates, army mates.
That's right, yeah.
And they were saying they remembered he was blowing the horn as they neared Scotland. He was playing Bluebells of Scotland.
He did. He stood up on the deck and played, coming into Greenock, Bluebells of Scotland. You want to hear it?
You bet. And as you played it, improvised on it too, Bluebells. Somehow you see the ship going into the mist, I guess you could say Scotch mist. in this case.
Definitely could.
Come back to Jimmy again, the guy you met and married, the American, rapper is the word, trumpeter Jimmy. Blues always played a role. We can't talk about jazz without talking about the blues, can we?
The essence of jazz, really, the blues. I know when I was on your show at WFMT in Chicago, I played, actually it was rather soon after Jimmy had died, and I played a little blues for you and for him. Blues for Jimmy.
Yeah.
Jamie, I used to call him.
Yeah. There could be no greater tribute to Jimmy McPartland or to any great jazz musician than a blues of that sort. And as you play that, Marion, I'm thinking again, I thought of a guy named Jimmy Yancey of Chicago,
yes.
Played How Long Blues, and he played, he was a groundskeeper for the Chicago White Sox for many years.
No, I met him, Jimmy and Mama Yancey.
Mama Yancey.
Sure.
And when he died, there was a tribute to him. And a mutual friend, Big Bill Brunsey, the blues singer, sang a song. It was in the evening when the sun goes down, you're not around. And she was saying, it was a tribute to Jimmy Yancey a week after he died or so. And his widow, Mama Yancey, cried out, sing it, baby, sing it. And he was singing, Big Bill was singing for all the widows of the world, not for Mama alone. And that's what the blues is, it's universal. Let's horse around with the blues. Can we? You play the blues, and all sorts of definitions for the blues. So I'll offer a couple of definitions as you're sort of playing a blues.
Same like, tempo?
Yeah,
like
same
that.
Kind
okay.
of test. Slow blues. The blues. The blues ain't nothing but a good man feeling bad. That was Big Bill's. The blues. the blues is nothing but a woman on a poor man's mind. The blues. The blues is all the things I wanted to do and never got around to doing. The blues. We'll try one more for size. And this is an old one. Woke up this morning, blues was around my bed. Ate my breakfast, blues was in my bread. The blues. You're playing a slow blues now. It's really everybody's music and circumstance at one time or another. Not all the same. We know that. We know where the blues came from. It came from African-American experiences, of course. But there's something universal about that, the blues. That's something you feel at a certain moment.
It's funny. It can be kind of bittersweet, or it can be... Yeah. Even happy, like some of those, some of those things that Count Basie did, the medium tempo. We had Joe Williams here, and he did some blues, and it's...
The line, like the sun's going to shine on my back door someday.
It's like the happiest thing you ever heard in your life, but that's what's wonderful about that particular form of jazz. I mean, there's so many tunes written on those chord changes.
Jimmy Rushing, when he sang for Basie the song... Hurry down, sunshine. See what tomorrow brings.
Jimmy
Well, of
Rushing.
Course, that's affirmation.
Well, he was so
Basie,
wonderful.
You mentioned Basie. What? He was the master of economy, wasn't he?
Oh, would, God.
How?
Can you
do
like,
a... You know, you imagine as you're playing that, just he wouldn't waste anything. It was there, and of course he had these guys backing him, Freddie Green and Joe Jones and Walter Page. But the economy reminded me of Joe Louis in The Ring. Joe Louis never ever wasted a punch, but when he delivered, that was it.
It's jabbing, wonderful.
That
to
was
think
it
about that because jazz is, should be the same way.
Yeah.
Like actually. There are times when, and I'm probably the worst example of this, of playing too much. In fact, Duke Ellington, who was in the Hickory House all the time when I was there, once said to me, "Oh, you play so many notes." Mm. And I didn't realize until like years later that he was trying to tell me something in a kindly kind of a way, like you're overplaying, like you're doing... You know, sometimes you get carried away and you...
So the Duke wanted you to be more economical.
Yes, he did, and I didn't realize that at the time.
Less is more.
Less is more. I don't know if Bill Basie did actually say this, but something like, when in doubt, leave it out.
Yeah, when in doubt, leave it out.
Studs, before we finish, something I would love to do was, I've known you for so many years, and enjoyed being in Chicago and being a guest on your show. And I'd love to do something I don't think I ever tried before, and that is to do a little musical portrait of you, the various aspects of you, the humor and the charm and the various characteristics.
Keep talking, I like your style.
All right, let's see what I can do. Thank you.
Marion McPartland's musical portrait of Studs Terkel. Can't think of a more fitting tribute for a man who spent his life telling the stories of America. Thanks very much for being with us today for this special remembrance of Studs Terkel, featuring his 1991 appearance on Piano Jazz. Tune in next week. Marion will be back in this host chair with another fascinating artist from the world of jazz. I'm Scott Simon. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to a special edition of Piano Jazz with Marion McPartland. This program originally aired in 1992 with Marion and her guest, Studs Terkel. Guest host of today's program has been NPR's Scott Simon. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV Radio. The producer is Sherry Hutchinson, recording engineer Andrew Milano, mastering engineer Bill Sexton, executive producer Bill Hay. If you wish to contact us, our email address is pj@scetv.org. Our postal address is 1041 George Rogers Boulevard, Columbia, South Carolina, 29201. Piano Jazz is made possible by Save America's Treasures, a partnership between the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Park Service Department of the Interior. The original program was made possible by a grant from Exxon Corporation. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and NPR. Contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.